From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn about a program called Medicine Fish and how it works to connect young people of the Menominee Indian Tribe with nature. Then we'll learn about some of the film choices for the Milwaukee Film Festival from the Black Lens programmer.
The theme that I created for the features and the short was centered around reckoning. So what are we reckoning with in our communities? And a lot of those things tend to be health, or memory, or loss, or grief, or romance, or love, right?
Plus, we'll visit Walker's Pint, the only lesbian bar in Wisconsin, to learn why having that space is so important for its patrons.
You will find, you know, in this, like, small little bar in Walker's Pint, like, just an absolute, like, army of people who would do anything to keep this bar going, to keep this space, like, existing.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Today, we'll take you into the Rare Books Room at Milwaukee's Central Library. But we'll start with this. Black Maternal Health Week is recognized each year in April to raise awareness, inspire activism, and strengthen organizing for Black maternal health. During this month's Black Maternal Health Week, U.S. News and World Report recognized 26 hospitals in 13 states for their dedication to improving Black maternal health. Aurora Medical Center in Grafton was the only Wisconsin hospital highlighted on the list for achieving excellent outcomes for cesarean section and unexpected newborn complications among Black patients. WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell is joined by Dr. Ann Windsor. She's been an OBGYN for more than 20 years. She's also the Vice President for Women's Health for the Midwest region of Advocate Health. Windsor says this recognition is a testament to the hard work the center has done over the years.
I think teamwork is a big part of that. Our nurses and our physicians and our what we call OB techs all work together to take care of each patient individually, but according to standardized guidelines. And I think that's an important key. But yes, we're so proud of them. There are over 2,000 hospitals in the country that provide maternal care. Even last fall, Aurora Grafton was recognized as one of the high performing in maternal care. There were about 300 hospitals recognized at that time. And then in recognition of Black Maternal Health Week, they announced the 26 hospitals in the country that are recognized for their high performance in Black maternal health. And yes, Grafton was the only one in the state, which is very significant. I think our commitment to providing respectful care is a big part of that recognition. And I think listening to our patients is a big part of that, really understanding what our patients are experiencing, as well as explaining things to patients. So as you know, labor is a normal, natural process, but at times requires interventions. So explaining when, why those interventions are needed is really important for that respectful care.
Something that sticks out to me in what you just said is the importance of listening to patients, particularly Black women who are historically not heard or believed when it comes to our needs or our pain in the healthcare field. And what I appreciate these days is that more of us are speaking out about that. What would you say Aurora is doing differently or dedicating more time, education, whatever it might be, that is setting you all apart from other locations when it comes to Black maternal health specifically?
So Aurora has participated in AIM and was actually one of the first health systems in the state to participate in that. And AIM is short for the Alliance for Maternal Health. AIM is a consortium of professional organizations that is really focused on improving maternal health across the country. So by participating in that, we have ensured that all of our nurses and our physicians are being educated on the most up-to-date information for improving maternal health. You know, it's shocking that maternal mortality in this country continues to increase. And according to the CDC, increased between even 2018 and 2021, so even recently. The thought is that some of those deaths are preventable. And the shocking part is that Black women are at 2 to 3 times more higher risk of death related to pregnancy problems than white women. So closing those gaps is essential. And I think AIM has been a really important part of that education for our nurses and clinicians. I'd say the other thing is we do focus on and are committed to helping our patients manage their chronic conditions. And by chronic conditions, I mean things like high blood pressure or hypertension, as it's known, diabetes, depression, or other mood disorders. It's very important to support our patients in managing those conditions before, during, and after pregnancy. So I think that's another very important piece is as an organization, we are committed to providing that kind of care across the continuum.
I want to ask, when did Black maternal health become one of the top priorities at Aurora Grafton?
I think it's been a priority for us for years. I can't tell you exactly when, but we've all seen it in the media. We've seen it in our publications that this is something we really need to pay attention to, again, because of that disparity and thinking that some of those complications are potentially preventable. One of the things we've worked on over the last couple of years is closing the gap in C-section rates. There is a national disparity in C-section rates, with Black women being at higher risk than white women. We know that C-sections are essential for good healthcare. They do improve outcomes. They do help prevent, you know, complications for babies, but they can also lead to complications for pregnant people. So if a person has a C-section, they're at more risk for infection, they're at more risk for bleeding and other complications. So there's been a national push to safely decrease C-section rates for low-risk pregnancies. Again, we can't prevent every C-section. We don't ever want to have a zero C-section rate, but we want to have a rate that's not higher than it needs to be. So we've looked at that across our institutions over the last few years and have been successful in actually nearly closing that gap for our patients at our institutions, which is very exciting. That's one of the measures that the U.S. News and World Report uses, is the C-section rate for low-risk pregnancies, as well as the unexpected newborn complication rate.
Dr. Windsor, you mentioned Black women are 2 to 3 times more likely to die from pregnancy-related complications compared to white women. And in Wisconsin, it's higher than the national rate. Black women are 5 times as likely to die. What have you learned Black women specifically need on their pregnancy journey before and after birth to close some of these disparities?
Communication is key. Having access to care is key. So being able to start prenatal care even before the pregnancy, to start thinking about what we call preconception counseling, where a patient can come in even before they plan to be pregnant to say, hey, here are my health concerns. How can I best manage them and optimize my health before I become pregnant? And that's key for everyone, right? Including Black women. And then having access to care during the pregnancy, having prenatal care to help prevent problems that could arise later in the pregnancy is key as well. And that communication that I talked about is so important. Respect in terms of listening and explaining things to our patients. I think we want to be able to engage patients in their care as well and understand, hey, this is why taking a prenatal vitamin is important. This is why another ultrasound is recommended. So having that kind of communication access to care, I think, is really key.
And I think it's important to note that that access is not universal for Black women. Dr. Windsor, do you have any final thoughts you want to share?
Thank you. Yes, I'm just so proud of our team at Grafton in achieving this recognition. I'm also proud of our teams at all of our Aurora hospitals, because many of them were very close to receiving the recognition and did receive recognition for being high performing in maternal health. So we'll continue to work and strive to provide the best care possible for every single patient, every single day, night, weekend, and holiday, so that we can have the best outcomes possible for the families in our state.
Dr. Ann Windsor is the Vice President for Women's Health for the Midwest region of Advocate Health. She spoke with WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter, Taryn Powell. The Republican National Convention is coming to Milwaukee in July. You can help shape our coverage by filling out our election survey. You can find the link at WUWM.com. What you tell us will help inform the stories you hear on Lake Effect and WUWM. In about 15 minutes, we'll learn about the programs offered to people 50 years and older at Milwaukee's Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. But first, we'll visit the Rare Books Room at the Downtown Library and find out what exactly makes something rare and worth collecting. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The library is a lot more than just books. And every month, the Milwaukee Public Library joins Lake Effect to share resources, book recommendations, and cool stuff you might not know about. This month is about books, but not just anything you can check out from the stacks. Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski visited the Rare Books Room at Central Library in downtown Milwaukee. She met with Rebecca Doherty, the Library Services Manager in the Rare Books Room, to learn about the collection that's behind the glass. Doherty begins by explaining what exactly makes something rare.
So what makes something rare at the Milwaukee Public Library and would have it in the Rare Books collection here is the age of a material or item. So there's a term called pioneer imprints, which refers to anything that's printed before 1600. Anything that's printed by an American press before 1801. Anything that is printed by a Wisconsin press before 1869. And then there are some things that are more specific to certain collections. For example, when it comes to cookbooks, anything that's published in the United States before 1850. For travel books, anything that's published in the United States before 1900. And for children's literature, anything that's published in the United States before 1920. Another factor that we consider when we're evaluating materials for transfer or inclusion in the Rare Books Department is if they're already related to our scope, the focus of what subjects we collect here in the Rare Books Department. Other things to consider are an item's aesthetic importance, including but not limited to, does it have a fine binding? Does it have really exemplary illustrations and important to the time that it was published? And really, most important for us here at Milwaukee Public Library, is the item or material at all associated with prominent persons or events that are specifically related to Milwaukee and Wisconsin?
So there's a lot to, you know, be under that umbrella. And before we get into how you collect these books, I want to talk about this room itself. Who were Richard and Lucille Krug, who the Rare Books Room is named after, and when was this established here at Central?
Mm-hmm. So Richard E. Krug was city librarian from 1947 until 1975, and he established the first Rare Books Room at Milwaukee Public Library. And his wife, Lucille, after Richard's passing, donated additional funding to Milwaukee Public Library to have this space that we're currently sitting in built and constructed in 2001. Previously, the Rare Books Collection was housed downstairs on the first floor of Milwaukee Public Library Central Branch since 1953 in the Ware McLennigan Room when Richard E. Krug established the collection at that time.
Okay, so in the history of Central Library as a building, this is pretty recent, the room that we're in right now. So let's talk about how it's constructed. There's massive glass walls showing some great bookshelves, posters, art, other materials, and it is closed unless you request to see things or it's open for public events. You can't just wander in this in the day-to-day. So can you share what components needed to be built, like to care for this collection properly?
Sure, yeah. So what we refer to as behind the glass is where all of the rare materials are housed, and that space is climate controlled for optimal preservation conditions. It is always kept at a temperature of between 68 and 70 degrees and always at the relative humidity of 40 to 50%. Research has shown that these are the ideal conditions for preservation of the various materials that we have in the collection.
So you mentioned the climate control. Is there any other, say, security measures or handling measures that you take with all the materials that are housed here?
Yes. So it's under very tight security. The behind-the-glass space is only accessible by a very few number of staff here on the Rare Books team, and there are multiple steps to be able to enter the glass, multiple layers of security. As you said before, the room is not open typically unless by appointment or for programs.
So you mentioned the parameters that these materials needed to reach in order to be considered part of the Rare Books material collection. Can you share a general overview to show us the range of materials that you have here? Because it's not just books for the Rare Books Room.
Right. So our scope is fairly wide, being that we're a public library and a very good-sized community here. But it does include things such as Milwaukee and Wisconsin history and imprints, names that maybe people may recognize, such as Frank Lloyd Wright and Increase Lapham. We have some local historical publications from the 1960s and 70s, such as Kaleidoscope and The Bugle. And then we have some really unique individual one-of-a-kind items, including the Book of Autographs and the Voices of John Plankinton. We also have an emphasis here in our Rare Books collection on natural history and ornithology, including a complete set of John James Audubon's The Birds of America. We're one of the few public libraries in the world to have a complete set, along with Audubon's Quadrupeds of North America series. We do, too, have quite a few seminal works on Native Americans, specifically about Wisconsin tribes. Other areas that we have strong collection focus in include religious materials. Historically, these are books that were printed and published. Advertising, specifically some of the materials from the Googler Lithographic Company, which did all of Pabst's advertising historically. We have a complete run of the settlement cookbooks from 1901 to 1991. And those are of important local historical significance as well, because they were initially published and edited by a Jewish American woman here in Milwaukee. We also have a collection of African American cookbooks. And then, as you mentioned, some things in addition to books, we have posters. You can see some of them here up on the glass. We have a Milwaukee concert poster collection that really focuses on the 80s Milwaukee punk scene. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we have some other fun things like zines. We just celebrated Zine Fest, Milwaukee Zine Fest here at Milwaukee Public Library. So that was a lot of fun as well.
Perfect. Mm-hmm. Off the top of your head, do you know what your oldest piece of material is here?
I do. So it's actually a page from a Vulgate Bible, which dates all the way back to the year 1240.
That's amazing. So with all these materials, ranging from this very first material in 1240 to some of the things today, what is the collection process? Like, are you guys constantly seeking out more things for the Rare Books Room, or are you trying to keep the collection, like, at a certain cap and rotate? Tell me about, like, what you do here and how you maintain this collection.
Mm-hmm. So oftentimes, the way that materials are added to the Rare Books collection is through transfer from other departments at Milwaukee Public Library. As time goes on, things become more rare, or perhaps their condition, they start needing some extra tender, loving care, and then they may be moved to our climate-controlled area, or we may discover them that they do supplement some of the collections that are already in the Rare Books collection. We do also accept donations, so occasionally items will be identified through the donation process that may sometimes come to the Rare Books collection if they fulfill some of our evaluation criteria. And we do not purchase any new materials with public funding. So anything that we would purchase, donated funds would be used to do so. So that comes through the foundation. And items that we are intentionally purchasing with foundation funds are adding to our growing zine collection and artists' books. So books that are created as art. These allow us to represent some historically marginalized and underrepresented voices and perspectives, and allows us to fill some gaps representing some of those points of views and lived experiences in our collections.
You mentioned there was a zine fest here and that there are certain things the public can come into this gorgeous room and see the materials. Can you share a bit more about public access to this collection? Because there is access, just not all the time, right?
Correct. So the public, any public, you do not have to be a Milwaukee Public Library cardholder. You can come from anywhere. We've had international visitors. Research, just for fun, whatever purpose you have, we are more than happy to have you. So the Rare Books Collection, items from it are available to be seen by appointment Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. And you can go to our website to make an appointment. There's a direct link there to do so. You can give us a call, or if you happen to be here in the building at Milwaukee Public Library Central Branch, you can come to the second floor to the Zeidler Humanities Room, and any staff that are at that desk can assist you with making an appointment and identifying items that you might like to see. And the materials that we have in the Rare Books Collection, you may find them through our County Cat catalog. In addition, if you go to the Rare Books webpage of Milwaukee Public Library's website, there's a link there that will take you to search a specific catalog that only gives you results for materials that we have in the Rare Books Collection.
So you pulled some materials for us to go through, so let's head on over and check them out.
All right.
Let's start with this massive book. This is the biggest book I've ever seen, probably. this is your book of autographs, correct? Is this one of your big things in the collection here?
Yes. So this is a book of autographs collected and edited by Lydia Eli. It weighs over 50 pounds. So as you were describing it as being one of the biggest books you've ever seen, it is quite large. Lydia Eli was a local Milwaukee philanthropist in the late 1800s, and she had a committee of other local community philanthropists who were trying to raise funds to have a monument built, and it is now here in Milwaukee, on 10th and Wisconsin, called Victorious Charge, to commemorate some of the fallen soldiers in the Civil War. So over a course of a several-year time span in the late 1800s, Lydia Eli and her philanthropic committee sent out these slips of paper to thousands of people, prominent people throughout the country, throughout the world, and requested their autograph. And then the understanding was Frederick Pabst would purchase this book of autographs, and then that would help partially fund the Victorious Charge statue. And then Frederick Pabst's family and estate donated this back to Milwaukee Public Library, and that's how it is here now.
I love it. That's some great fundraising. Maybe public radio can take note. Should we ask for a bunch of autographs from someone?
I just think it's so fascinating to think, how did that even happen? How could that possibly happen today?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just so remarkable and incredible. Ms. Eli and her committee organized all of these by different types of people. There are autographs from politicians, educators, writers, musicians, artists, and they fully indexed and alphabetized this entire book. So it's really just amazing to see all of the autographs and additional notes and artwork and music written that were included in the slips that were sent back.
And next we have another local history tie. It's called The Voices of Friends Concerning John Plankington. And I requested Plankington simply because one of the parking lots I go into for work is off of Plankington. And I'm like, I don't know much about Plankington. So can you share some more about this book and one of our Milwaukee historical figures?
Absolutely. So John Plankington was a local meatpacker, and his daughter, Elizabeth, commissioned this book that we have here, The Voices of Friends Concerning John Plankington, Milwaukee's foremost citizen, father of the West Side, upon his death. And it was all hand-illuminated, lettered, and illustrated by Susan Frackleton and her daughter, Gladys, over a two-year period from 1911 to 1913. So they were commissioned to do this work. And it includes the tributes from 12 of Mr. Plankington's friends, including Patrick Cudahy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Another name we know.
Right, exactly. So we affectionately refer to this item here at Milwaukee Public Library in the Rare Books Department as the Frackleton.
Okay.
The artist, because Susan Frackleton was a very prominent local artist of the time. She's known for her ceramic work, and she went on to write books about artwork and how women could earn a living creating art and be able to support themselves and their families. And then her daughter, as I mentioned, she was an artist too and worked with her mother, Susan, to create this commissioned piece, The Voices of Friends Concerning John Plankinton. I mean, look at this.
Oh, more details, yeah, on the back of the cover.
Every page. Mm-hmm. You can see why it took 2 years.
Yes.
I mean, hand illuminated is just what you might think that sounds like it means. It's all done by hand, all of this detail. This is real gold leaf here in the pages.
Like hand-drawn, but so uniform, too.
Oh,
like,
my goodness. It's
such
just
attention.
Incredible.
Yeah. And then we have one more thing that you pulled for us, and it's one of your personal favorites. Can you tell me about what we're going to look at? It's something from 1499.
Mm. Okay. So this is the Hipner Otomachia Polyphily. As you said, this was published in 1499.
Wow.
Yes. This was published by a very famous publisher at the time, Aldus Manutius. He was a Venetian publisher. Authorship of the book is still somewhat of a mystery, but many historians think it was authored by a Dominican monk by the name of Francesco Colonna. And they think this because the amazing, beautiful lettering at the beginning of each chapter, if you take the first letter of each of those, it spells out an acrostic, including that monk's name. It translates to, Brother Francesco Colonna loved Polia tremendously. So this particular item is unique for so many reasons, not just because of its age, not just because of the really important publisher who published it, not just alone because of the mystery around the author, but also, in fact, if that is the author, he was a bit controversial in his time. This material here, different scholars have different opinions about it. There's subject matter in here that's quite racy and erotic. And if you think about a Dominican monk in the late 1400s writing this, he also had some other instances throughout his lifetime where he did and said and wrote some questionable things according to the church. And I think at some points he was on the brink of either leaving or being asked to leave the church. So that, to me, is all quite interesting yeah. and exciting as well. But in addition to that, this is a really seminal work because it's one of the first times that text and illustrations were married together on the same page or across the spread of multiple pages. There's also typeface that were invented or created at this time for this specific item that are still used and influenced typefaces used today, including Bembo and Roman typeface, which was produced by the artisan Francesco Griffo.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. And I want to thank you so much, Rebecca, for having me here today and showing me some of these great materials. I so appreciate it.
Yes, you are so very welcome. I'm very, very happy that you decided to visit.
Rebecca Doherty is the Library Services Manager in the Rare Books Room at Central Library. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski for our Books and Beyond segment. At WUWM.com, you can learn more about the collection, how to visit the Rare Books Room, plus free events like Art Book Club. Just because we stop going to school doesn't mean we stop wanting to learn new things throughout our lives. The Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at UW-Milwaukee gives opportunities for members to continue learning through classes, interest groups, local tours, and travel. Osher's learning community got its start here in 1982, and it's for adults 50 years and older. It's open to people from all educational backgrounds. The only requirement is a desire to learn. To learn about Osher and how they foster lifelong learning, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski speaks with the director, Sarah Grammer, and the advisory board president, Greg Jenks.
So let's talk about Osher. The key words lifelong learning are especially important to note. So what is Osher and who is it for?
Well, I'm the director at Osher. I've been here since July of last year. And Osher really has three major focuses. One are our classes, which are in person, largely at our Hefter Conference Center location on Lake Drive, and via live stream. We now offer pretty much all of our class content hybrid. So you can come and enjoy that in-person experience in the classroom or from wherever you're at. And that means we're bringing in members from even outside the Milwaukee area who are zooming in from Wauwatosa or even Washington State if they love what's on the calendar this week. Another area of programming are our Go Explorers. Those are opportunities to get out in the community with us, to visit local places and sort of see Milwaukee from the tourist's eyes, right? And those even go so far at times to be day-long bus trips. We'll go to Chicago and look at museums. We'll go up to Green Bay for the day if there's something special going on. And then the third type of programming we do are our travel trips.
What I find interesting about this and intriguing is, like, I miss school in the sense of learning something. I don't miss homework. Obviously, we don't miss paying for school. But this seems like the ideal way to, like, still be involved in not just the community, but keeping your brain active.
Well, that's the beauty. There are no tests, no need to take notes, though some people do. And I'm in the same boat. I don't know that I fully paid as close attention in school as I should have, but here you really get to choose from, you know, the topics that you're really interested in a nice compact 75-minute lecture. So like you say, we have everything from, you know, music to history, to literature, to science. So there's really something for everyone, which was what really attracted the organization to me.
So this program is nationwide, the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, but the Milwaukee chapter has recently celebrated 40 years. What's been some of the growth and changes that stand out to you the most?
I think the number one recent area of growth has been offering all of our programs in person and live stream via Zoom. Again, that just allows people to be able to enjoy our programs from wherever they are or whatever's going on. You don't have to let rehab, a broken leg, being out of state, and adjacent appointments stop you from getting in on these rich learning experiences. And Audrey, I just wanted to mention Osher. So that is a reference to the Bernard Osher Foundation, who we were able to get an endowment from. And that helps offset the cost of our programs. And so that's how we got the Osher label in front of our Lifelong Learning Institute, like so many, I think it's 125 other chapters around the country. And the wonderful thing about that is it really does help us keep our programs affordable. It's only $45 a year to be a member at Osher. Actually, right now, it's only $30 for new members because just the spring and summer term are left in this program year. Our membership year runs September 1 to August 31st each year, including three great terms full of new classes. And then our classes start at $10. So it's very affordable to get the kinds of classes that you're interested in.
On the note of accessibility and outreach, I do want to talk about your core membership base. So it's considered for older adults, which is 50 and up for this group. But older adults are an important part of the community. But as people age, isolation is often common, especially once people retire. So how do you conduct your outreach to get people interested into incorporating this into their lives? Like, especially if, say, they're not UWM alums or don't live on the east side by where you do a lot of the presenting.
The organization really has relied on word of mouth, pretty much. When I retired in 2017, I had never heard of Osher. and luckily came across a little article in the journal Sentinel about it. But for the most part, it's friends of friends who encourage people to join. We're trying more outreach efforts to make people more aware of it, because I don't think we are very well known in the community. And one of the selling points, as you say, is the in-person classes and the ability to socialize. For me, the membership really took off once I got more into volunteering for the organization. When you go to classes, you know, sure, you chit-chat with people, but once you really start working in a group with other folks, you start building that peer group, and that's where it really gets to be fun.
Post-pandemic, we certainly don't have a big marketing budget, so the struggle to get the word out about Osher is real. However, I think our members do the biggest part, because not only are they telling their friends how much they love the programs here, but they also create a consistently welcoming environment for anyone new who comes in the door. Our team very much is focused on diversity and inclusion in our membership. And so, you know, we're taking the flyers we have to local libraries and retirement communities, and we've done some outreach to local senior centers. So we're using our feet, I guess, so to speak, and word of mouth to try to let people know how special these programs really are.
Sarah, you mentioned that you recently started as the director of OSHA here in Milwaukee. So what drew you to this role and the work that the Institute does overall?
Yeah, I come from 5 years in Illinois, overseeing a large senior center where we did some similar programming. And I was really attracted to this role when I learned about the history, you know, 4 decades of going from an all-volunteer senior guild to today, you know, a membership organization with well over 1,200 members, offering classes 5 days a week here in person and online. It was just a great opportunity to be involved in something that's well-developed, well-run, and growing. I was excited by the quality of the classes. We have retired professors, professors from other universities that come in and give their time, and people just in all sorts of specialty fields talking to us about the work they do here in our community and the research that they you know, have published and been involved in. So the educational aspect just really drew me in. I myself am a lifelong learner, a huge library lover. I want to learn everything I can. And so to be part of that on a daily basis just really drives me.
Greg, you mentioned you were a member, then volunteer, presenter. Now you're part of the advisory board. Can you share a little bit more about what OSHER means to you, or a program or event that really stands out that you would say encompasses the OSHER experience?
Well, I think just in general, the volunteer experience. I worked for the Franklin Public Schools, and I always said teachers are good people overall. And I think that's a similar description of our members. You know, we attract lifelong learners, good, caring people. And so the ability to meet new friends and engage with new people at my advanced age is very exciting. And so to be able to work with them and, you know, find some meaning. The volunteers do a significant portion of the work for the organization, like bringing in all the speakers that you talked about. And so you quit work and you're looking to find meaning in your life, and here's an opportunity to do that with a new peer group. So that's overall what really sticks out for me.
I'd just like to add, Greg is not just a presenter here. He is by far one of our more popular presenters. He had a program, for example, that was called The British Invasion, and it was all about how Beatlemania took off here in the United States, and our members just raved about it. Greg really likes music, and his classes are infused with fun and a lot of music, video clips, and great research.
And that's one of the nice things, too, about the organization. I mean, yes, we're lucky that we can get professors from universities and authors and other very learned individuals. But within the membership, there are a lot of people with their own set of expertise. And so a lot of our speakers are members that just enjoy getting up and sharing their knowledge with everyone.
Well, Greg and Sarah, I want to thank you both for sharing more about the OSHER Lifelong Learning Institute with me today.
Yeah, thank you so much for your time, Audrey.
Sarah Grammer is the director of the OSHER Lifelong Learning Institute at UW-Milwaukee. Greg Jenks is the current president of their advisory board. Registration for Osher's summer programming opens on April 30th, and you can learn more at wuwm.com. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, but ahead of that, we do need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at wuwm.com. Then listen for new episodes starting in May on Thursdays during Lake Effect and Fridays during Morning Edition. Coming up, we'll speak with a social media influencer who is working to empower women and queer people to learn car care and maintenance. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Car trouble and car questions can cause a lot of stress for drivers. For some, learning how to maintain a car is a bit of a mystery. And when it comes to needing repairs, things can get expensive and confusing. Kaya Milstein is a Milwaukee-based automotive educator, social media influencer, and writer who is working to make cars less complicated, especially for women and queer people. She creates educational content on social media and on her blog, Mechanic Shop Femme, to give car owners easy-to-understand information. Milstein joins WUWM's Eric Vaughn fellow Nadia Kelly to talk about car myths, sexism in the automotive industry, and her new book.
On the internet, you go by Mechanic Shop Femme, and I was just wondering, what is Mechanic Shop Femme? What type of topics do you talk about underneath that name?
So Mechanic Shop Femme was my handle on Instagram when I started my blog. I thought a lot about it, and I was like, oh, what should I call it? I want to make sure that I bring my whole self to this work, because working in shops, it's not exactly the most welcoming or enjoyable environment to work in, especially as a fat, queer woman. So I wanted to make sure whatever I did was going to bring all parts of me into the job. So Mechanic Shop, because I talk about car repairs, and Femme, because that's what I am, and I sort of put it together. And I primarily cover automotive ownership from every angle. So from buying a car, to selling the car, to insuring the car, to car maintenance, how to find a mechanic, and everything in between. If it involves regular people going about their daily lives with their regular vehicle, that's what I'm about.
Did you previously work as a mechanic?
I worked for about 7.5 years in the repair and collision industry. I primarily worked a customer-facing job where I worked with the people who came in to fix their cars. So I was like the intermediary, or how I like to put it is like the mechanic interpreter. So I would take the information the customer gave me to the mechanic, and then I would bring that information back to the customer.
Is this what initially sparked your passion for car ownership, stuff like that?
When I started in the automotive industry, I did not know anything about cars. I used to say I didn't know a bumper from an oil change, and it was 100% true. In fact, when I interviewed for the job, I interviewed for a job at Sears department store, and then they asked me what department I wanted to work in, and like a true Capricorn, I said, whichever one makes the most money. They offered automotive or appliances, and automotive sounded more interesting. So, of course, they followed up with, so do you have a driver's license? And my answer was no. Did not have a driver's license. Got my driver's license for the job at Sears Auto Center, the one that used to be in Glendale and Bayshore. And then I started, and it kind of just ended up being a natural fit. Like, it certainly wasn't something that I thought I was going to do long term. I thought this was a job where I was going to make enough money to put a roof over my head. You know, I had just aged out of the foster care system, and I needed work. It was 2013. There wasn't a huge amount of jobs available. My experience didn't serve me in any kind of like customer service or restaurant types of jobs. I couldn't even get interviews there. So just getting this job was huge. And once I got it, kind of like the rest was history, as they say.
What was it that you liked so much about this experience?
if you've ever heard like an English teacher or math teacher say, you know, they live for the light bulb moment where they're teaching something to their students and it doesn't make any sense to them. And then all of a sudden, click, you know, the light bulb goes off and you can see it in their eyes like, oh, I understand now. Like, this makes sense. That was kind of how it was for me. So that's definitely one element to it. But it's also just bringing this basic information. Like, I'm not teaching how to take apart your car or any kind of fancy information. I'm bringing the basics that everybody should know, that they should have been taught, that they were often not taught because they were queer and their parents were worried about making them unqueer instead of setting them up to survive in life, or because they were women and their parents didn't think that that information was appropriate to teach them or important to teach them. And I want to bring this basic knowledge to everyday consumers, because when you go into the shop and you come in and you already expect the worst and you already think that everybody is going to scam you, I'm trying to show people how to navigate through the challenges that are there, giving them the tools necessary to better understand their cars, to better understand mechanics, to know what kind of questions to ask. Things that make people's lives easier and better. In most of this country, we have to have a car in order to have access to better job opportunities, be able to take on more jobs. I remember when I was 18, I didn't have a driver's license and I didn't have a car, and I was trying to find a job. And my foster parents lived in Glendale in an area which wasn't accessible by bus. And it was very complicated and very difficult. And I strongly believe that getting that first car really helped me move out of poverty. If I wouldn't have had that opportunity to take on more jobs, to go further away, to be able to have access to these career opportunities, then I wouldn't have gotten to my next step. And for a lot of people, it's like that.
Could you tell me more about just like the type of impact that you want to have with the way you educate people about cars, especially as it relates to inclusivity?
Have you ever heard of blinker fluid?
No.
Okay. A common thing that most people who don't know anything about cars hear from mechanics and car people and YouTube videos is blinker fluid. Blinker fluid is nonsense. It doesn't exist. It's been invented by the gatekeeping car bros and car enthusiasts and industry people to make fun of people who want to know more about their car, who want to fix their car. So they'll be like, oh, don't forget to replace your blinker fluid or other kind of stuff. But blinker fluid doesn't exist. It's fake. It doesn't exist. Because people think it's funny, but it's not funny because it is it's like the word that's like the tip of the iceberg that's wrong with the industry, right? I approach my work, my book, my videos, all elements of what I do by trying to think of how it will impact the most amount of people and how I can be inclusive to the most amount of people, particularly to the people that have not been included in these conversations and in these education opportunities and in this industry historically since the beginning of time.
Wow. Thanks for sharing that example for me. I think it really clarifies how your work is countering the existing frustrations that people encounter when they're trying to learn about something.
If you're a woman and you walk into a shop and you're treated poorly or oversold products or you aren't explained services and stuff like that, now imagine how it is to work as a woman in those same places. So if shops become better for their employees, they will also become better for their customers and vice versa.
Thinking about the work that you're doing in educating, you are currently in the process of writing a book?
I am thankfully done. Done writing the book. The book is available for pre-order now. It comes out on April 9th.
Could you tell us a little bit about what someone could expect to find if they pick up the book?
Sure. So the book is like putting the last decade of my automotive experience into one concise, easy-to-read, easy-to-understand guide to car ownership. This is not intended to be the only part of your car ownership experience. Like, it's intended to be used in conjunction with a good mechanic and things like that. And it starts by telling you how to buy a car. and then moving into how to insure that car, and then how to find a mechanic for that car, and then how to maintain that vehicle, what maintenance you should do yourself, what maintenance you should do at the mechanic. Well, obviously, you could do whatever maintenance you want by yourself, but given the people who will be reading my book, most people will be more interested in that. So let's say, you know, your old car is kind of on its last legs. There's a lot of problems with it, and you are deciding whether you need to replace it. You go to the section where I talk about how to decide if it's time to move on. And then you make your decision at the end of that. And then you could go to the chapter where how to sell your car. And then you could go to the chapter on how to buy another vehicle. And it all kind of works hand in hand.
Now I'm sort of reflecting on all that I've been told about cars and how much of it may or may not be accurate. Why do you think that there is so many myths out there that people don't think twice about checking if it's accurate or not?
Misogyny, racism, homophobia. They're so busy trying to gatekeep cars from more than half the population that if a man says something, then obviously the man is right. And the worst part of all of this is that most of the time the man is wrong, because these things negatively impact men too. It doesn't just, people think, oh, sexism, it's just about the women, or racism, it's just about the people of color. No, these things impact every single person. When you block half the population from automotive knowledge, you are also blocking every single man that doesn't know anything about cars, because now cars are tied to your masculinity. If you ask a question about cars to your mechanic and it's a silly question, then you are looked at as less of a man, or you might feel like you're less of a man because you're going to ask this question. But that hurts you too. So you pick up some myths from somebody, you hear something on the internet, you don't ask clarifying questions, then you teach your kids that and you teach your spouse that. People say my book's for teenagers. It is, but it's also not. It's for women in their 50s and 60s that have recently gotten divorced or their spouses have passed who've never taken their car in for an oil change. It's for queer folks and women who never had the opportunity to learn these types of subjects, or they learned them from somebody who didn't know what they were talking about, perpetuating this, you know, these continued myths. And it's for men. It's for men who don't feel like they can ask the questions, that they don't feel like they have the information, because it's emasculating.
Kaya Milstein is an automotive educator and the author of Mechanic Shop Femme's Guide to Car Ownership. She spoke with WUWM's Eric Vaughn Fellow Nadia Kelly. You can find a link to Milstein's blog at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. And WUWM has a new politics podcast called Swing State of the Union. It explores why Wisconsin is a deeply purple state and why it's so important in this election year. You can find a trailer at WUWM.com. The first episode will be available on Wednesday, and you can find it wherever you get your podcasts. The time has come for spring cleaning, and tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll talk with an expert about how to tackle cleaning out and decluttering your home. That's tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.